Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsley, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Von Braschler. He's released a book quite recently called Seven Secrets of Time Travel. And in this book, Von examines time, timelessness and time travel from the viewpoint of Eastern mystics, scientists and Native American shamans. So welcome to the program, Von.
Thank you, Mike.
Now, I must say right away, you're a man after my own heart. I love all the ancient civilizations. I started my interest when I read some of the readings given by Edgar Cayce about Atlantis and Lemuria, and that sort of whetted my appetite. And the older the civilizations are, the more interest I have in them. So let's start there. I mean, where did your interest start?
Well, let's see. I guess I had some early encounters that were rather personal. I don't know if that's what you were referring to, in perhaps, or simply, I've always been interested in time and light, and I find they're connected. And right. I had an encounter when I was 12 years old. I got on a bus, and I was going to go with a bunch of friends to a berry field and go swimming. And then we were going to eat some berries, and then we were going to come home on the bus. And I got deathly sick, and I started walking, and because it wasn't time for the bus to return. And I started walking, and I started walking, and my friend said, well, where are you going? I said, well, I see there's a railroad track, and I'll get on the railroad track, and it will take me to my home. They said, it will? I said, yes, yes, yes. I was 12 years old, and I was very sick, and I was probably delusional. So I was on the tracks just a short while, and suddenly I was in front of my house, miles away, and I walked in the door and collapsed, and I had a burst appendix, and I barely made it. But here's the funny thing. Railroad track doesn't go by my house. There's no railroad track by my house.
Right.
So I thought that was the kind of a out of time, out of place sort of thing. Mm. And it got me very, very interested. And it took me a long time to understand that. And then, like a lot of people, I one day had a traffic accident, and time slowed down. And it was just bizarre how the time just slowly. I had all the time in the world to make my decision what to do. Now, I know not everybody experiences an accident that way, but many people do. Many people have time shifts or time slips, or they have unaccounted minutes in the day. Where were they? Or they seem to be two places at once, and then they're back in their body. And they seem to experience time shifts. And now since I released the book, people are coming to me and wondering things that I hadn't even thought of when I first wrote it, such as, back to your original questions about ancient civilizations, Mike.
Yes.
Someone asked me the other day, he'd written a wonderful book on 2012 and the Mayan calendar. He said, I just read a book called Seven Secrets of Time Travel, in which the author opened my eyes to the possibility the Mayans knew way back when what was going to happen because they were able to time travel.
Right.
And I thought, what? And I thought, well, if I could do it today, why couldn't they do it then? You know? So I've always been interested in time. Time is fascinating. People have dreams of prophecy where they see into the future. I wrote an earlier book on dreams, and I would go on the radio and take in callers, and people would say, well, I have dreams of the future. I said, well, did they ever come true? They say, pretty much. You know, and the more I look into prophecy, people seem to be traveling into the future and seeing the future. Well, this isn't so rare. Shamans have done it for years. Native American shamans in New Zealand, shamans all over the world have been able to go into a deep, deep trance, a vision quest, or a meditation out-of-body experience, if you will. And they seem to go backward in time or forward in time, and they come back with tremendous insight for their people. It's been going on for centuries, and it's nothing new. Samadhi mystics in India go into a samadhi state, various samadhi states, in which they experience shifts in time and space, or as they explain it, out of time, out of space. So I know that some of these exercises that I've gleaned from these disciplines will work.
Right. But isn't it true to some extent that the shamans also induce the experiences by, I don't know necessarily whether you would call them drugs, but by inhaling sort of smoke and that type of thing?
I think in some cases they do drugs, yeah. Mm. And in some cases they don't.
Right.
I think that's a constant throughout every shamanic experience.
Okay.
The shamanic experience, the trance-like state they go into, is induced in various ways. It's just with smoke or exhaustion or being in a remote place. And there are very, very, very different ways to do it. But in some cases, they do that. But I don't think that's the determining factor.
Right. Now, what was the other experience, if we can still carry on with this question of time slips, when you were walking down a street and you suddenly found yourself somewhere else?
Well, when I first started realizing that I could do this, I had no control over it. I had not studied it. I just kind of fell into it. And I was rather kind of drunk with success, I guess, because I was just slipping in and out of it at will at the oddest times. It was kind of exhilarating that I could do this. Well, I had some rather bad experiences. One was I was developing film in the darkroom, and I worked for the newspaper at the time, way back when we did darkrooms. And suddenly I realized that the light had timer had gone off, and I had no idea how much time had elapsed since I didn't have a clock with me. And another time I was walking down the street, and I remember this very distinctly to this day, walking at one end of this small town and stepping off the curb to cross the road at one end of town. And the next thing I knew, I was at the other end of town. And I didn't remember anything in between, but I did remember where I was out of body. So I was kind of bilocating. And that was a little discomforting. But yeah. I think a lot of people have car accidents like mine, and they experience a sort of control over time, either where time seems to stand still or it goes very, very quickly. I've talked to people who travel great distances with very little gasoline because they're in an emergency situation. I was on the radio just the other day, and the host said, "Oh my, that happened to me." She said, "I was driving and I realized I had no gas, and suddenly I was somewhere else. You know, it's like time sped up." So apparently, you know, as many people have alluded to throughout history, there is the ability to apply your perception to time and seemingly manipulate time.
Yes. I suppose if you go along with the idea that everything is in the now, then you can obviously have experiences like you have. But when you spoke about this experience you had in the developing study, do I recall correctly that you actually found yourself somewhere else?
In which instance was this?
When you were in the developing study and you lost time.
Yes, I was walking, and I had what many people describe as a time slip, a gap in time, and I couldn't account for something, and suddenly I was somewhere else. So it's really hard to explain it unless you experience it. It's like suddenly you're transported somewhere very, very, very quickly. And there you are, and you have no idea how much time has gone, but you've traveled quite a great distance, and you can't really account for it. It doesn't quite add up, you know.
So would you say, just talking of an experience I had when I was a sales rep, I'm retired now, I can remember driving into a town and driving through it, but the thing was, when I came out of the other side, I couldn't remember passing certain buildings and offices which I was familiar with. It wasn't a strange area. Now, I hear other people say that when they're driving, sometimes it seems almost as though their consciousness has moved somewhere else, and they think, how on earth did I do that part of the journey? I can't even remember doing it. So would you say that is anything to do with timelessness?
Yes, I think so. I mean, part of the things I studied, having been a reporter, I started to consider how much we do not notice, how many things we just take no notice of, and how few things we actually do observe, you know. And I started to notice this when I would drive, and I would drive, and there would be so many things that, you know, because I would travel the same, to do this right, I would travel the same route again, and then I'd say, well, what did I miss? I missed practically everything. It seems like, to me, well, now there's a fellow who came up with a great explanation for that, and he studied time, and he is the young physicist Julian Barber, and he wrote a book, The End of Time, and he describes, he kind of takes it back to Einstein's theory, a special theory of relativity, where he talks about the instant being what we would call now the now, and Barber says that really what we see are just snapshots, that the mind, the eye looks at light reflected off of objects upside down, and then takes a quick snapshot. And we want to think in our desire to control our environment, our life, our destiny, our progress, that we have this kind of continuity moving progressively forward toward a wonderful finish. So like a movie, we would be at the beginning of the movie, there would be a crisis point in the movie, there would be a turning point in the movie, and then it would develop more, there would be a wonderful ending, and then it would come to an ultimate conclusion, and you could play the movie again. Well, he said that what we see are snapshots. So his comparison was that you go to a gymnastics meet, and you are watching a gymnast do a tumbling exercise, and the gymnast starts, strikes the pose at the beginning, and then you see that, you take a very good snapshot of that with your mind's eye, and then it starts to go into a tumble, you take a picture of that, and then it's a blur, you know, and you skips it forward, fast forward, and then comes out, jumps up into the air, does another tumble, you take a picture of that, a blur, 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 snap forward. And then there's the end where they pose at the end. They stick their landing, and it's a wonderful pose, and everyone applauds. So you have about, you know, snapping pictures with your mind's eye as quickly as you can, as though you had some kind of a high-speed camera. You snap pictures as fast as you can, and you have about 6 snapshots. And all you've captured are just instants, single instants. And you want to play them forward in your mind as though it's a continuous, progressive movie with a beautiful beginning, middle, and ending. But you've missed most of what was. And he said, this is all life is. This is how we experience time in the physical world. I want to draw a distinction between what I describe as the exercise of the Hindu science, the Samadhi mystics, the shamanic experience with time travel, and look simply at the everyday way we experience time. And we experience time as just a series of snapshots, and that's all it is.
Right. Now, do you think that when people have out-of-the-body experiences where they are aware that they've left the body, maybe this could even be from a sleep state, do you think that's a similar thing? Because they seem to often move into a different dimension.
Yes, I'm tempted just to flat say yes, but I've done this in other interviews, and then people come back and say, well, he's just describing astral travel. And in a sense, I am, but it's a very specialized type of astral travel. One travels in a consciousness vehicle, in higher consciousness, the higher mind departs from the physical body and goes somewhere. And most often, we send our thoughts in this way. And, you know, the various books have been written about thought form, thought transference. Even today, we have modern research by Dr. Emoto, hidden messages in water and thought power, and how quickly and how accurately thoughts move, go somewhere, and have a tremendous impact, transformational impact. But what I'm talking about, in addition, is moving the whole energy body. So I think there's a difference between simply sending one's higher mind or consciousness and sending one's total energy body. I look at the many layers of subtle energy bodies that envelop all of us. You know, we have the astral body, you know, we have the etheric body, the mental body, the causal body, the Buddhic body, and so forth and so on. So that if you look at, say, let's say the Hindu Eastern model of the subtle bodies or energy bodies, and in other cultures they talk about the luminous body, the webbing, the energy that surrounds us. People talk about the aura that envelops our body with their various colors of light, which correspond to various planes of existence. And taking that energy body with you, with your consciousness in, if you will, an astral out-of-body experience is much more profound. You know, you tend to have a whole greater experience when you find yourself in two places at once, experiencing something not so much physically, but with, let's say, an etheric body where you seem to have more experience, more awareness, more, well, you're bringing with you many, many levels of your conscious being. So I think when many people speak about astral projection or astral travel, traveling in your dreams, this is very, very much like what we're talking about, and it makes it easier for people to picture this. But I am talking about taking with you, you know, your astral, your energy bodies. Right. We are, after all, light beings encased in a physical structure. Doesn't mean we're entombed there. Doesn't mean we can't rise from it freely.
Right. Now, I can relate to an odd experience that someone told me about when they were driving their work vehicle, and this particular person suddenly found himself way above the vehicle looking down at it, and yet at the same time he was still aware that he was driving it. So that's an involuntary thing that happened there. But yeah. Can you control things like that?
Yeah, I think. I try to come up with some exercises that I think are fairly safe and easy to follow, and reliable in that in doing them, you know, once or twice or several times, one becomes more accustomed to leaving the physical plane and its limitations of the physical universe, and traveling beyond space, beyond time. I think there's a way to get comfortable and acquainted with that way of moving. I have different prompts there for how to safely set yourself up to leave the body, how to go about going somewhere, and you know, as I say, I've taken these from not from people that have built time machines, but people who have actually, in a meditative state, east and west, experienced life beyond space and time as we know it.
Right, but I believe you actually feel that there are better methods than meditating to learn how to time travel.
Yes, that's true.
But nevertheless, I suppose you would say that when someone can relax themselves and get into that higher level than normal, perhaps that opportunity opens up for them.
Yes, the basic technique I have calls for a deeper level of meditation and than most people have encountered or tried or heard of, and also a more active level in that you actively seek to leave the body, but not haphazardly as often one does, but with focused intent. So I've added some elements. One is creative visualization, building a picture of where you want to go and what you want to do, and then actually shutting down. I think a lot of people, when they meditate, they are satisfied with becoming still and quiet and tuning things out inside and outside themselves a bit, you know, but their foot is in one. They have a foot in both worlds. They're very conscious of the room they're in, and partially conscious that they're experiencing something a little more profound, and that really won't bring you where we're going. So what I advocate is absolutely turning off the brain, slipping into a state of higher consciousness, activating the higher mind, which I think operates totally independent from the physical brain, as it can operate outside of the physical body. Then focusing your intent and your will on going there. And, basically that's it.
Traveling into the past or the future, I should think, fascinates most people. But can you get to the point where you can actually say, going into the future, say, I'm going into a period 50 years ahead, and actually do that? I mean, can you determine precisely where you're going?
I don't think so. I don't think it can be quite that precise. For one thing, it's very hard for us with no frame of reference for the future. No conscious frame of reference for the future, for our future, our personal future. It is very difficult for us to zero in on that, as we could zero in with something in the past, which is we feel a closer affinity to, a magnetic attraction, if you will. You can get close. I think this is the problem when a lot of people try to do prophecy. Really gifted people do prophecy, but they're not extremely accurate, because I think it's very, very hard. You lack the physical magnetic attraction, almost We have no frame of reference for the future, and it's hard for most of us to perceive of it.
Right.
So I think you would do the best you can. You paint a picture. See, I get rid of all words. There's no words or mental thoughts in my meditation exercises. You form a picture. Use visualization to form this picture as exacting as you can, knowing what you know. Put in the knowns. Let's say you want to find yourself in the future. Okay, you just picture yourself. You picture yourself, maybe not the way you look now, but picture yourself. And then you picture where you want to go in the future, and you want it to be, and you're thinking like 50 years, you know, and you're thinking where it will be. You program it as best you can. And then when you completely go into a meditative state where you've tuned out all the thoughts and distractions inside and outside, and you have absolutely a blank slate in your mind's eye, that's when this picture comes forward that you've painted, you've created. That's the picture. It becomes your roadmap, and then you go there. And you'll find that you can't, particularly in the future, go with pinpoint precision, but you'll gain some insight of what you need to know.
I would guess that, in view of what you've just said, that it must be somewhat easier to go back into the past because you've got some reference, possibly to visualize the period or the place that you want to go to. Now, would you agree with that?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true, and it explains why most of us have an easier time going back in the past. And most of us are more comfortable going into the past. Let's be honest, most of us don't want to face the future. So we go into the past, and we glean it for whatever insights we can. How did we get to where we are today? Who were we? What were our dreams? What dreams were forgotten? What lives did we lead? I mean, you can go back into your childhood. You can go back into yesterday, or you can go back into two lives ago. You can go back, you know. But it's easier because it's you. It's you going to a very comfortable part of you, which is you. So the you that's in the future for most of us seems alien to us. Shouldn't be that way. I think the time is absolutely looped. The time, the past, the present, future happening concurrently. But we haven't experienced it, so we have no frame of reference. We have no attachment, no personal attachment to the future in the same way we do the past.
Right. Now, I seem to recall, if I've got the right name here, that it was Ingo Swann who, I think, worked for the government at some period of time, could travel like some other time travellers by simply having a map reference to go to.
Yep.
I'm sure you're aware of that. What do you think about that as a method?
Absolutely. Well, I've talked to people who, they say I shouldn't write about this, but I'll allude to it. As many people are aware, there are government special operations of a military sort, and there are also psyops, or special operations of a military sort, which are psychological or extra sensory type things. So there are people who are very gifted at, say, remote viewing or bilocating or sending thought form, thought power. And I've met someone who did this, and they can look at a map. They can look at a, how about, who was the famous psychic author who wrote about, I'm drawing a mental blank, but there was an author who was involved in this, and he worked for the government, and he did this, and he reported very odd things, like they could look at radar sightings of ships or planes, and they could make them disappear. You know, and yes, there are very many ways to do this. All you need is to know where it is. That's why I say you draw a mental picture of where you want to go. You just need some frame of reference. So absolutely, you could look at a map. Absolutely.
So it's whatever suits you.
I don't do that, but yeah. I believe that people do.
Yeah. I suppose it comes down to whatever really works for you in the end. Now, what I am interested in knowing, you've explained how the sort of work you're doing helps people to transcend the physical body, but it offers new hope, you say, for the treatment of illness, emotional problems, and addictions. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is a special interest to me. I see the way that we experience time as basically absorbing, transforming and projecting energy, usually in the form of sunlight, electromagnetic radiation, sound waves, and how you transform that and how you project that is totally up to you. But the dynamic quality of the process of transforming and projecting this energy that we're given freely is truly makes you an agent of change. An agent of change is like a dynamo. The human body, the way we transform and transfer energy makes us dynamic in our own way, like electrodynamo. And the other way of looking at this as agents of change is that there are very many illnesses that occur outside the physical body and eventually descend into the physical body. I think if everyone stops to think about this concept, they'll understand it. Now, we understand it in different ways. We have, let's say, spiritual ailments, or we have emotional ailments, or we have mental ailments, and we experience that outside of us as we experience things on the subtle energy body level, the layers of our being that envelop us, these so-called subtle bodies that surround us, and if untreated, if undetected, these things will eventually descend into the physical body and be manifested physically as ailments, which are very, very difficult to treat because you're looking at a symptom and you cure the body and the problem is still there. So now, and I don't mean to discredit medical science as now practiced, or any form of therapy as now practiced, because they've come to understand this through time. They now treat the physical body, and then they realize that there's a psychosomatic illness that's outside the body, or in addition to, or in your head, or let's say is not visual and not physically manifest. But they will treat this independent of your physical ailment. So I think to heal outside of time and space, to step outside of yourself in a higher consciousness form, one heals oneself from the outside looking in. You absolutely do need to heal yourself on all levels. This is holistic health. This is nothing new. I'm just suggesting that you can use these techniques also to be an agent of change in your own life, to step outside of yourself as higher consciousness and deal with things that are not so easily dealt with within the physical restrictions of the physical world, in your physical body. It is very hard for another person to detect when you are mentally, spiritually, or emotionally ill on any level other than manifested in the physical body. My book is really about transcending the limitations of the physical world, the manifest world, to the world above, which is the unmanifest world, the world of energy. The world of energy is envelops all of us. It impacts all of us every day, and it becomes part of our life. We are basically light beings encased in a physical body.
So, John, are there any dangers in people doing this type of work? I mean, in the sense that they may find themselves in some negative situation. I mean, and what can they do about it?
Yeah, I can't think of any. I mean, I think it's such a remote possibility. There's always, I suppose, a possibility. If you're talking about traveling in space and time outside the physical body, and an energy body and a higher consciousness vehicle, one goes there without arms, without legs, without a hand to write contracts. You cannot kill your grandfather. You cannot kill your granddaughter. It's not going to work because you are going there as a perfect witness in a energy body. You're going to go as the shaman has for centuries done, gone and through time and space, to bring back insights to his people. This is safe. You're just going as an observer, healing yourself. We always heal ourselves. You know, anyone who is an honest therapist or a healer or a medical doctor will have to admit one heals oneself. One must have the wherewithal, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, and within your will to be well. They assist you. They are tremendous aids in assisting you to heal. But there are many ways that we suffer outside of physical pain.
Okay, that's fine. Now, because we made a late start, we've only got a few minutes left. I couldn't find a website of yours. Is it true to say at this time that you do not have a personal website?
Oh, well, now, sort of I do. I develop my author profile page on Amazon. So if they look me up or the book, they'll find a funny little picture of me and kind of what the activities I'm doing, where I'll be, and they want to meet up with me somewhere along the way. It's kind of a schedule. My publisher, Inner Traditions in Rochester, Vermont, has developed a Facebook page for me, which a person can go to. And that's about it.
Okay, so what was the reference you said as regards to Amazon? Did you say it was a profile page?
Profile page. It's a profile page on my Amazon page.
Right. So they put a search in for your name and put Amazon. Do they be Amazon books beside it, and they'll find your profile page?
They'll find my profile there.
Right, okay, fine. So obviously that is also where one can obtain your book.
Yes, and I try to update the profile with, you know, it doesn't have any words of wisdom on a day-to-day basis, but the other hand, we do put the activities in the schedule. So, for instance, this program was announced there, and future programs would be announced there.
Well, I'm going to have to thank you very much for coming on to my program.
Thank you, Michael.
We could have gone on a little bit longer. It's a very interesting subject, and I don't think I've come across too many people that, if you like, specialize in it. So that was very interesting to have you on. Can we? Oh, that's okay.
No. My goodness.
Bom, we have a little bit more time than I thought, so we'll
see,
use it up.
There's proof that time doesn't really exist as we commonly perceive it.
well, it does when you run a radio studio.
Yeah.
Now, what I want to refer back to is you were a former member of Holistic Studies and the Theosophical Society. And you also authored a book about chakra reading and color healing. Now, is that something that you've sort of left behind?
Oh, no, no. I see it as all the same. It's just that I take different approaches to the same thing. I wrote a book on dreams, and I wrote a book on healing with pets, and I see it all as all the same. I think I see it as basically a better way to understand how we process energy in our lives. And it's all energy. I mean, time is energy. Matter is energy, you know. It's just understanding that. So I'm very interested in chakra healing and that sort of thing.
I mean, do you do that yourself, or is your intent to teach other people how to do it?
Well, yeah, I both basically do a little workshops where I'll show people how to perceive chakra colors emanating from the body and using it as a tool for energy healing and aura reading as well. Kind of setting up the conditions where people can, you know, learn to read the colors of energy coming off a body.
Right. That would be the auric colors, presumably. But am I right in thinking it's a little bit more difficult to see the chakras themselves?
I see them as basically the same. I see that the aura is, of course, corresponding to the more the subtle bodies. But actually, I think to be more accurate, I know there was a book by Dr. Karagula, a medical doctor, and psychic healer, Dora Kuntz, a while back. It was I think they really figured this thing out. The chakras exist on every subtle body level. So when you're looking at auras, you're really looking at chakras. The chakras are the dynamic outpouring of energy from the body, and the aura is a general reflection of it. So it's almost impossible, I think, in my own personal experience, to separate the two. They're not usually described together, but I think that the chakras do have a color, and because they are energy. They are energy, energy centers in the body. And so to fortify and work with ailing chakras, or to get the chakras operating more efficiently for self-regeneration, one needs to look at the colors that are emanating from the chakras. And we see this as looking at the auras. So it's like, you know, it's like looking through one end of the telescope, or the other end of the telescope is the same telescope.
Right. Is it true to say that if you can see the auric colors or the chakras and they're out of balance, that that also has an effect on the physical body?
Yes. Yes. One of my first teachers just trained me in spotting ailing auras. And you know then that they're just not generating energy properly. And then what you do is you try to go in and determine what chakras aren't working. And there's various ways you can do that. I mean, acupuncture, aquapressure works, you know. Various ways to do this. Energetic healing, there are very many different approaches. But the idea, and of course one can do exercises, but the idea is to get the chakras to work on their own, correctly. So an ailing chakra will eventually lead to many problems. But once again, we have to remember the chakras operate on all levels of the body. So if you have a chakra that's not operating on the emotional body, or one that's not operating on the mental body or something, then eventually inside your physical body, you're going to have the same problem, because that energy just isn't traveling.
Right. Now, I understand the crown chakra is actually above the head, so it's not actually placed over the physical body. What is the function of that one?
Well, that would be when one's contact to divinity, the greater reality, if you will, depending on how you want to look at it. It is our divine connection. It's more pronounced in some people than others based on their spiritual evolution at that point in time. But that's the primary function there. That's our antenna to the greater cosmos. or as Carl Jung might say, the collective unconscious.
Right. Is it also true that for one who can see these colors in the aura, that if they are dark, very dark or mottled, that indicates a lower vibration and possibly illness within the body?
Yes, that's true. That's true. When we see something that resembles black coming from the body, we know that death is very, very imminent. When we see gray, we know that they're very, very, very ill. And, of course, they're all shades of colors. Just as within the spectrum of, and let's be honest, as human beings, we only really perceive seven colors of the rainbow. So we're looking at variations of those colors, and, you know, the heart chakra is not a distinct color, but it goes through gradations. So what I found is that the chakras are very rarely exactly the color prescribed to them. There'll be variations, and often a blending of one chakra into another chakra. So you'll see like yellow and orange often blended together. You'll see like red and orange blended together, blue and indigo blended together. And then, you know, you'll see pink and where there should be red, and it indicates to you how intense the activity of the healthy or unhealthy chakra is.
So if you looked at someone, say, who was highly spiritual, what would you see that would define that condition, say, opposed to someone who is just an average being?
Well, the auric color burst emanating from the body would be there, but they wouldn't extend out very far, and the colors may not be very bright. In the East, they use the term vibrant and bouncy. You know, it's that the more vibrant and sharp and intense the colors are, the more alive they are. They're more active, more electrified, if you will.
Right. So some people see these apparitions and they think they've seen God or Jesus or a very highly spiritual being. And they seem to be often surrounded by a bright, although not glaring, white light. Now, is that also part of the aura, or is that a different condition?
Well, there is a kind of white light that's sometimes coming from the aura. So, and sometimes when it's very hard to read the aura, especially when you're first learning to read the aura, you tend to see everything as white light. You know, it's sometimes very hard to switch it on. That is the aura reading, so that you can see more, you can see in color, you know. So that often when people are just learning to read auric colors, they're just reading everything as white light, shades of white, you know, it's dull white light, sharp white light, intense white light, you know, blinding white light, you know, ghostly white light, you know. So, yeah, it's true.
So, is there anything so far that I haven't touched upon that you would like to mention? Because you have to bear in mind, I haven't actually read your book, but I've found some information about it.
Yeah. I had written an earlier book on perfect timing, where I explored basically, like everybody else, the power of now, you know, the power in the present moment. And I think that's an extremely powerful thing, extremely powerful. On Earth, it is great, great magic. But I guess what I'm beginning to perceive and have described in the new book, Seven Secrets, is that one can go beyond the now.
So what is it about the now that gives you the opportunity to have some power?
Well, you slow down things and you bring to the present moment tremendous power of the presence, you know. And if you fully occupy the present moment, you can experience basically timelessness. And in timelessness, you seem to have also great control and flexibility of time. You can do a lot. You can do an awful lot if you can control time to the point where you can just slow it down. You know, I think some of your fans might remember the early book by Istvak Bentov, who died a tragic death in 1979 after he wrote a brilliant book, Stalking the Wild Pendulum, where he describes if you can stare at a clock and learn to stop the clock where it stops, then you know you can stop time. But this is not time. This is not so much time travel. I mean, Einstein talked about if you could stop time, you could travel at the speed of light. And if you could travel faster than the speed of light, you could actually transcend time, forward, backward, so forth, and so forth. But the ability to stop time is really quite profound. It is really quite amazing. So I don't mean in describing traveling various timelines forward and backward in time in a higher consciousness energy body is to demean anything anyone has been saying in this great consciousness movement we're experiencing about the present moment, the eternal now. It is huge.
Okay, now, you have another book called Conversations with a Dream Mentor, and you talk about controlled dreaming. Now, what would be the purpose of that?
Well, it's very much the same. I talk about moving in your dreams, controlling your dreams, and setting up and programming your dreams so that you can leave the body in an astral-type voyage. Leave the body in a higher consciousness and go somewhere. And the point behind this is that everyone does this pretty much anyway, but it's haphazard, not programmed, and not analyzed. So if one is going to learn in one's dreams, if you're going to learn in your dreams to keep a dream journal, if you think dreams can be profound, and some dreams aren't, some dreams are just, you know, recapitulation of the day's event. But if you actually go somewhere in your dreams and actually experience something that seems rather vivid and lucid, then you really probably should be trying to control your dreaming to the point where you can effectively learn better in your dreams. So it's really an attempt to use lucid, vivid dreaming in controlled out-of-body meditations to learn in your dreams.
Would that apply to a situation, say, where someone thought, I'd love to see my father and mother who've already passed on? Could you believe that you could actually condition it or program yourself to meet them? I mean, does it apply to people, in other words?
Yes, but I would say, and I have a moral conviction here, being a devotee of Helena Blavatsky, who did not believe you should summon the dead to have idle conversations. Going backward in time and visiting them at a different time is perfectly great, wonderful. We're not talking seance here. We're talking going backward in time and visiting them. Absolutely good idea.
Right. Would you do that within the immediate period before you go to sleep?
Setting it up?
Yes.
Yes, it's the same basic thing, same basic outline. You want to visualize where you want to go in your dream, and then you you try to tune out your thoughts completely till you see a blank screen, tune out all external distractions, and then I can't emphasize enough that this is rapid beta. This is not getting into a dream state. You're going to be highly awake. Your higher consciousness is your super consciousness. You're going to be highly awake while your physical body is completely asleep. And then you bring forward the picture that you've created visually, and that's where you want to go. That's where you go. That's where you go in your dreams. So it's just another way to do it. People are more comfortable sometimes going in their dream time, their sleep time. Basically the same thing. I wrote that before I wrote Seven Secrets, and I could see in the dream book that I was really describing just a little bit more than lucid dreaming, but actually programming your dreams for time slips. So,
that's
yeah, you know, and most people will go in their dreams, they'll go to some place that's very near to them in terms of proximity and time, people that are known to them. But obviously one could go, to other realities, other worlds, other lifelines, other lives. You're not at all restricted in the sense that we're restricted in this physical world of ours.
It's interesting that you refer to seeing a screen, because sometimes when I'm just in that state before you drop off to sleep, in my mind's eye, I see a screen, and sometimes I think I see people in it, and things happen, but I have absolutely no control over it. Would that be normal?
I think that there was a wonderful book that came out. It was a theosophical publication. It came out in, I think, the late 70s or early 80s by, I can't think of the fellow's name. I think he's Czechoslovakian. And the book was called Theater of the Mind. It's fascinating, where the mind tends to think of things as like a theater. We tend to think of things as, in our mind's eye, we seem to have this idea that there's a movie screen. I think a lot of people have that. Maybe that's how we invented the movie screen. It's just so, you know, innate to us.
Oh, well, I guess in time, perhaps if you try and apply yourself to it, perhaps it is possible to control what you see in some way.
Yes, yes, right. I mean, if you can see it, then you can reach it, you know. I think that's true.
Fine. Now, I think as a final subject, Vaughn, I'd like to ask you about something I read that you stated, that when you've been out of the body, or when you time travel, presumably, that you've been to places that aren't of this world. Would you like to tell us about any of those experiences?
Well, some are really strange. Some are really strange. Not unlike other people have experienced, I didn't have anything that was greatly different. I went back and explored past lives to the point where I was just kind of a gaseous form. So I know that, I've lived many strange lives. Those were strange. Reliving very vividly a boyhood in ancient Troy and watching my city fall, that was very strange, very chilling, because it was so vivid. Going beyond into other realms, let's say, I did experience many astral levels, which were not pleasant, where you're very heavy and the world is very orange. Not pleasant. I did go to some place that one might call heaven, which I did not find very pleasant. many places extremely pleasant. I have found that if you can visualize it, you can you can go there, you know. And I guess I know this, you know, having done this and going and exploring past lives, I've actually since then found people in this lifetime that I knew from my past life visions that, you know, where I'd gone into my past, and they had similar memories, so that was a wonderful reunion, if you will. So it's very revealing, and not in an idle sort of way. I mean, we're, after all, in a process of becoming and evolving, and life is a process. And I think it's very legitimate for one to try to explore and understand your past and what you're about, and where you came from. I think this is a noble pursuit. You know, it was considered noble for the shamans, is considered noble for the shamans. It's considered noble for the Sumadhi mystics of India, and other shamans around the world do it. And it's noble. It's something that one does to grow.
Certainly sounds very interesting. Now, as a final question, Von, when you've been traveling around, have you ever met any space beings?
I don't know. I don't know. I do believe that there are beings that we consider space beings that are probably, how would you say, closer to us than you think. I mean, I think that there are dimensions that we cannot see. There are levels, existences near to us. I think that an explanation for the spaceman might be not as exotic as we think, in that they've traveled physically not very far. They might even be from our future.
Right. Well, it's been very interesting to hear your story, and particularly of your own experiences. It's a very, very interesting subject. So thank you, Von, for coming onto the program.
Thank you, Michael. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we've got our sort of full time in after a late start, so that's worked out very well. So thank you again. All I'm left to do now is to announce next week's guest, and I shall be off myself. So
great.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Right, friends, as usual, I always comment, don't I, on the fact that we have these very interesting guests. Next week, I have Frank Joseph to talk about a book that he edited that carries, as he calls it, compelling evidence of ancient immigrants, lost technologies, and places of power. And the book is called The Lost Worlds of Ancient America. And having looked into that one, I can tell you that also should prove to be an excellent subject to talk about. So thank you for being with me today, and I do hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you.